Okay, the civil justice meeting will come to order. We do have a quorum, and with everybody that's here from, still here from the tax committee, would you please leave so that we can go ahead with the civil justice hearing? You've had quite a while to clear out, 20 minutes, so hopefully you can leave. The first bill in is Representative Gill. 1406, would somebody move Representative
Owen? I'll move this bill.
Oh, Representative Owen moves House File 1406. Representative Gill, is there any amendment to this?
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Mullery, Representative Owen has a amendment.
Yes, I believe this one's been handed out in advance. I'll move the 809-217 amendment.
Okay. Representative Olin moves the 217 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Go ahead, Representative Gill.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And just briefly on the bill, what the bill does and is it changes the structure of charitable gambling taxes, which is long, long overdue. Long overdue. You can ask any of your charities in any of your communities if this is... I think I heard the tax chair say today in committee that, I think she said, unilaterally we charge on profits, taxes. Well, not in charitable gambling. We charge on the growth. But that, nonetheless, that's not what this committee is interested in. As I understand it, you're interested in a provision that is relative to televised racing on line 23 and 24 of the bill. And I have Mr. Holton here to explain both the lines on the bill and the amendment.
Mr. Holton, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The lines that Representative Bill was referring to would establish a treble damages clause of action in the circumstances described in what would become Section 1 of the bill, well, what did become Section 1 of the bill in the last committee. And that's a situation where several years ago, Congress changed the Interstate Horse Racing Act, which is Title 15, Section 301 to 307 of the United States Code, related to electronic wagering and off-track wagering, and made a federal policy on this topic, subject to a state's authority to specifically make it illegal if they so chose. This has given rise to televised or internet systems that operate racing programs, and they are illegal, but they cost us, especially in states like Minnesota, that hasn't made the changes necessary, for instance, to do OTB, they cost us market share. These companies are willing to make compensation payments to states like Minnesota. In Minnesota, the public officials have been unsure or against the idea of even receiving money from these other vendors, and the vendors are willing to pay if I can make the state law clear. I think that we also have an action against them because this is totally legally under federal law, which they have to be operating legally under the terms of this bill.
Mr. Holton, can you just wait for 1 second? I want to explain to the committee that the only reason this bill is in this one is lines 1.22 through line 2.22. So go ahead.
And focusing on that, Mr. Chairman, I think the question that you were probably asking is, does this merit a treble damage cause of action? My response on that is that this is basically going to work, if it works at all, in a voluntary negotiated basis. This having the cause of action is going to give the Minnesota people a little more leverage in those negotiations. In terms of trying to actually bring this cause of action that's created, it would be extremely difficult. It would be difficult to prevail it would be difficult to establish the exact damages. The level of difficulty and the level of difficulty, I think, would justify a treble damage action. If the chair and the committee do not feel the same way, I would still like to have a single damage action.
Okay, Representative Dill, is there any opposition to this bill from anybody? Okay, any discussion within the committee? Okay, Representative Olin renews his motion to send House File 1406 as amended to the Tax Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Thiessen, House File 254, but we're taking up the Senate File 265. Would somebody like to move the bill? Representative Hortman moves Senate File 265 to go where? To the General Register. Is that correct?
I believe so, Mr. Chair.
And do you have any amendments for the author?
No, I don't.
Okay, Representative Thiessen, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the gist of this bill is fairly straightforward, to make sure that people who can't see have access to crime alerts. And I'm imagining the reason that the bill is in this committee is because we're classifying data as private data on individuals. So if someone requests that that they be given this information, that information should be kept private. Which I think is fairly straightforward.
Representative Thiessen, I guess the reason it was here is because there's a cross-reference. So it doesn't have to go into our data practices bill, was what I'm told, but it had to come here just because there was a cross-reference. So, is there any opposition to this bill? Okay, then any discussion? Okay, then Representative Hortman renews her motion to pass Senate File 265 to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Thank you, Representative Houston. Are we going to do this? Okay. First of all, Representative Johnson moves the minutes of the March 18th meeting. There's an amendment? Oh. where it says House File 403, the first line, a bill for an act relating to environment. Representative Hortman, I assume as part of your motion that we'll delete one of the relating to. Is that okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was Representative Johnson's motion, but
I have another
edit for you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Johnson's motion. Is that okay? Okay, then all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. And now Representative Hortman has an amendment too.
Mr. Chair, on the second page after House File 720, Hillstrom, at the bottom of that section, didn't it say Representative Hillstrom renewed her motion and the motion prevailed?
Doesn't it say that? Oh, in the second one. All in favor of the amendment by Representative Hortman, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Now Representative Johnson renews his motion to pass the committee minutes of March 18th as amended. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Thiessen, your bill 1341. Representative Hortman moves House File 1341 to the General Register. Is that correct, Representative Thiessen? Okay, Representative Thiessen, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill addresses Minnesota's Newborn Screen Program, which is an award-winning program. Minnesota's received national awards for it, and it's really undisputed that it saved dozens of lives of kids in our state and minimized even more life-changing injuries. What the Newborn Screening Program is really all about is identifying those conditions that kids are born with that are treatable, but if they're not caught early and not treated early, can really have devastating impacts on the lives of the kids. and you know, and many of the members on this committee know that, but my family has personal experience with the success of this program with one of our kids, and who a condition that was caught because of this program, and he's doing great right now as a result. But I just know how important it is, and we will have two brief testifiers who can speak to that as well. But I did want to just walk through the language quickly, and just the main point here is that this bill has been around, has been through the process for quite some time, and right now, in the form it is right now, it's really been whittled down quite substantially to what is really necessary to preserve the newborn screening part of the program. And I'll talk more specifically about that. The first part of the bill basically sets up a specific protocol for the collection, storage, and use of newborn screening samples, which is different from our general rule about genetic information. And what's important to know about this part is that the protocols for newborn screening that we've had in place actually predate the adoption of the language that's set forth in Section 1. So we actually had rules about the newborn screening program and how that stuff is treated well before we put in this new language that's shown in Section 1, not the new language, but the existing language in Section 1 a couple of years ago. And I think that that's significant because one of the questions here is why we're treating this differently. The fact is we've treated this differently for quite a long time. This legislation also, I think it's important to note, reflects what passed off the House floor and goes even farther in the direction of the opponents, quite honestly, two times last year with over 100 votes. Really what this language is a further move towards compromise on the bill. And it was vetoed last year by Governor Plenty, but we have worked with the administration on this language that's before us now going forward. So just quickly, what it does, prior to collecting a sample, what the protocol is, you have to provide the parents with information, identifying and explaining extensive information about the tests and what the tests will be used for. This language is in the bill that passed last year. It's the same language that passed last year. Secondly, there has to be a record that that actually happened, so that the information was provided and that the parents had a chance to ask questions. And that was also passed off the House floor last year. That's the same language, or almost identical language as last year. In addition, it includes information about the different types of objections that can be made fairly clearly, and this information is also in the bill that passed off the House floor last year. The new part of the language is that, if you recall from the past, one of the big concerns has been about the fact that these blood samples can be held indefinitely. What this bill is now saying is that the samples can be held only for 25 months and then need to be destroyed. And so that is a significant change from the legislation last year, and I think takes care of one of the big objections that this bill has had in the past. And the second thing that it does is it also says for that 25 months, it can only be used for what is called newborn screening program operations. And so what those things are making sure that the tests work, making sure that we are eliminating false positives, making sure that the equipment that's used to do the test is in calibration, and also the potential to develop some new tests. And that really is what the bill is about. And again, I just want to emphasize that after 2 years, with the one exception that if a parent actually consents to keeping it longer, so informed consent to keep it longer, they can keep it longer. But that would take place kind of down the road after the tests are taken. The point is that we will not be holding samples for more than 25 months. And it's really 2 years plus a month to destroy them is the thought on 25 months. So that's what the bill is about. It has really come a long way since we first started having this discussion, you know, several years ago. And I know that Representative Holberg has been involved in many of those discussions and others for a long time. And I don't think there's any question that there's been a lot of progress and movement made towards trying to reach a compromise on this legislation. I really believe that the legislation as it's drafted here now is about as narrow as we can draw to make sure that the program continues to operate successfully, and it is a successful program that saves lives. So I would just like to testify briefly to share their stories if we could.
My name is Tracy Christopherson.
And I'm Jennifer Arbison.
Ms. Christopherson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My daughter, Maddie, who now is 8, was born in Florida in 2000. She was not newborn screened because they did not do that. It wasn't optional or anything. To keep it short, she pretty much, you know, we never had trouble with her pregnancy. She was born healthy, no problems, took her home 6 months into her life. She started getting really sick, and we'd carry her to the ER limp, and it would take like 10 days to bring her back to where she could even sit up again. And we did this several times. On the third time, I remember going back, and I'd always say it was a virus. The doctor looked at me and said, she is critically ill. And I was just so numb, like, well, she always had viruses. How can this be such a big deal? So on the fifth time, she was scheduled for a colonoscopy, and the prep of fasting almost killed her. And that's when we finally found out they took blood. We found out that she did have a serious metabolic disorder. And I guess looking back and thinking, why would anyone not want to have to screen? Because we were happy, healthy, never heard of any type of illness in our family. And then she ended up having this, and we later found out if we would have let her sleep through the night and not rest her in at 3 a.m., she would be dead now, like so many other children who have slept through the night thinking, well, we'll take her in the morning to the doctor. So I would like to think that she went through this 4 years of her life struggling with an unknown disorder, and I would like to think that it wasn't for nothing, because I would hope people could learn from that, because you would never want to go through what we went through. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Christopherson. Ms. Arbison?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My son, Gabriel, was born in 2003, so he had the expanded newborn screening program done. At 3 days old, his blood sugar dropped to 34, and he was completely unresponsive. That was prior to the testing coming back, because there's a bit of a delay. When the newborn screening testing came back, it indicated he had MCAD, and MCAD is the same disorder that Tracy had indicated, and it causes low blood sugar and liver functions to go just goofy when the child is unable to eat for any reason. During the first 2 years of his life, we were in the hospital 8 times and almost lost him 2 or 3 times. My concern is the newborn screen saved my son. There's no doubt. That's what saved my son's life. The testing was done. I was aware that it was being done, and it saved his life. And the fact still remains is that we're arguing privacy or whatever over baby's life. That if it gets changed to anything but an opt-out, babies will get missed because there are no symptoms. Parents don't have any symptoms. They all of a sudden just have this child that has problems, and like Tracy said, they sleep through the night and take them to the ER and can't figure out what's going on. And now my son is 5 years old, and he's in kindergarten in Gregla, and he is a happy, healthy little boy because we went into it with the knowledge, well armed with knowledge, on how to take care of him. So I guess for me, it's a no-brainer. It saved my son's life, and somebody sat here and testified that it was a good thing, and I believe it. I believe it, because babies will get missed otherwise. Babies will die.
Thank you, Ms. Arbison. And that's my understanding of your presentation. Okay, thank you. There's a couple people I wanted to testify against, Twyla Brace and Carrie Bearder, I believe. Ms. Brace, go ahead. Hello.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome.
Chairman. I'll need a page.
Hi there. I'm Carrie Bearder, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for being here, for letting me speak to today. I just want to share about my own experiences. I've got 2 children. My oldest was born in 2005, and I had no idea that any type of testing was going on. The next morning, I went into the nursery to see how my boy was doing, and he's crying and has the bloody heel, and I was all surprised by that. And then I asked the doctor what was being done, and they said it was a testing and that I could look on a website or, you know, find out. And so then when my next daughter, when my daughter came along, that was last year, 2008, that Alexa was born, I still didn't know anything about the DNA database and the storage of the DNA. And that's specifically why I'm here today, is not so much on the newborn screening, but I'm here about my concerns about removing the parental consent verbiage, because it's DNA. You know, that's about as private and as personal as you can get for information about a person, and I'm here to speak for parents that we should know about what's going on with our kids, and the only way to ensure that we know is to have something that we're signing off on. I really advocate that just having an opt-out is not going to be enough, because you're given so many pieces of literature, and as a newborn parent, especially my first was a month early, and I didn't even have the nursery ready, and so you give me a stack of literature, and then somebody says, okay, they've been given the information, they can opt out, that's, I really think, is not enough when it's something as serious and as personal and private as our own DNA. I know if there's a court case, they can't take my DNA without something from a government saying that, you know, a legal document saying that they're going to test my DNA. And so that's my concern, is that this DNA is being kept, it's being stored. Even the hospital staff didn't know anything or didn't tell me anything about it when after my daughter was born. And again, I was trying to get information about what tests are they doing, and I did my research after, and that's where I found out that there was even a law. It shocked me when I found out that there was a law saying that they had to have written, informed parental consent, because no way was there anything that I was asked to sign. So that's just, I'm just saying that I really feel like our DNA is the most personal, it's the most private thing that you can have, and I think that as parents we absolutely should have the right to read through something and say that, yes, we are okay with you storing and researching and testing on our children's DNA, genetic information.
Thank you, Ms. Bearder. Ms. Brace, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare. And I want to be very clear that this is not about the testing. This is about what happens to the blood after the testing is done. We're not objecting to the testing. We're objecting to what happens and to the fact that there is a law today that requires informed written consent from parents before the blood is stored, before it's used, or before it's given away to researchers. And the health department has not been following the law. And because they have not been following the law, we now have a lawsuit from 9 different families that was filed about 10 days ago. Let me just be clear here to say that on page 1, lines 21 to 24, that is the real purpose of the bill. And please note that is section 13.386 of state law. So that's in chapter 13, and it is the genetic privacy law. The rest of the bill is in chapter 144, the Department of Health part of the law. And essentially what this will do is this will exempt the entire newborn genetic testing program, including storage, use, and dissemination, none of which are actually legal in law today and are actually prohibited by law. But it will legalize what is being done today illegally, and it will exempt the entire genetic testing program from the genetic privacy law. It will exempt the program as they collect the most personal information about you, your DNA. It will protect, it will take the parents and the children out of the protection of the Government Data Practices Act, even though the government is collecting the most personal information on you that you have. I just want to pass this out for you. I know that when you get this in your hands, you're going to think, well, this is kind of big, but it's actually not, because all I did was underline one thing on each of them, and it is actual documents from the Institutional Review Board of the Health Department that shows how they are extracting DNA from the newborn baby blood samples, all without the consent of the parents. The very first page actually gives you the chief administrative law judge's ruling when the health department tried to appeal the administrative law judge's decision. And so the chief administrative law judge says very clearly there is no express provision in the law that exempts the blood spots from the coverage of Minnesota Statute 13.386. That's why I asked you to look very carefully at page 1, because that is 13.386. The rest of the bill is chapter 144. So what it does is, page 1 limits the rights of the parents, eliminates informed consent rights, eliminates genetic privacy rights, and the rest of the bill is about what the health department promises to do after they have eliminated those rights. And if you just look through here, I'll just give you page 7, 8, 10, and 11 all mention following DNA extraction or after isolating DNA, etc. And this is all done without consent. Page 12 is the question about, is there research being done on vulnerable populations? And you'll notice on that one they say yes for children. Page 13 is a project that the health department is doing with Perkin Elmer. It is one of the largest newborn screening private corporations in the country. And they're using newborn blood spots here, essentially for free. And you'll notice at the bottom that who's their local contact but the salesperson. And if you go further onto page 16, it says here the evaluator, and that's the health department. The evaluator understands that Cook and Elmer may publish the results of this evaluation and that they may be used for commercial and or scientific purposes. So it is a commercial industry as well that is being helped by the fact that this is being done illegally. And so we are asking you, as Citizens Council on Healthcare, we are asking you to not let them get out from under the law, which they have not followed for 2.5 years, but instead to protect the privacy of children, to protect the privacy of parents, because of course that's the parents' bloodline as well, and to keep the informed consent rights in law rather than stripping them out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Braith. Is there anybody else that has to testify in this? Okay, then we'll open it up to any discussion if there is any. Representative Holbert,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think my questions would be for the Department of Health.
Okay, is there somebody from the Department of Health here?
And I think, members, for clarification purposes, I think where this gets confusing is the legislature gave the Department of Health the authority to conduct a newborn screening, but the administrative law judge ruled in, I believe it was 2007, that they did not have the authority to store indefinitely and to use for research purposes. So there's kind of a delineation between different activities and whether they had the authority to do what they've been doing as a normal practice. And it's my understanding that I don't think that they've changed their practices, and I just want to get on the record you know, what they're doing and what their intent is on a few things.
And Mr. Chair, just if I could, and I know President Holbert asked questions, there's been a lot of discussion about what the department is doing under the current law and whether that's legal or illegal. I think we also need to focus on that we're actually changing the law to address some of the things that have come up here. And so there's a little confusion, I think, with the last testimony kind of conflicting that stuff as well.
Well, and
not your testimony.
No, and I appreciate that, but I just think it's confusing to members to hear, you know, what's legal and what's illegal. I don't think anybody's making the assertion that conducting the newborn screening is not authorized by the Department of Health. It certainly is. The additional testing, more than 50 tests. We added hearing screening, I believe, last year. And I'd also like to at this point say I don't have a problem with the newborn screening. I recognize the value that I've spent countless hours talking to people about those issues, but I do feel that we need to make sure that people's privacy interests are protected, and that's kind of what I want to get on the record. Given that there was a ruling by administrative law judge about indefinite storage, has the Department of Health destroyed any blood samples on their own, in other words, not without the direction of a parent or a data subject, but have any blood samples been destroyed since you began collecting them over a decade ago?
Would you state your name for the record?
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, Mark McCann, Program Manager, Newborn Screening. Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, the answer is no. We have not destroyed any dried blood spots unless the parent has consented for their destruction and exercise their rights.
All right, and if I might, on the card that you use to take the 5 blood samples and you send 2 or 3 of them to Mayo and you keep part of them, in an example of the form that I received in a document, it actually showed that the patient's and mother's name were replicated on both halves of the form. So does the Mayo Clinic get the baby and mother's name and date of birth and private information about them on their half of the card?
Mr. Chair, Representative Silver, yes, they do. In order to conduct newborn screening efficiently, they need that information as we do in order to establish appropriate contacts for follow-up in case of a presumptive positive test result.
All right. And
Representative
Mr. Chair, if I might then, can you tell me in your bill as presented what your intent is with the test results?
Representative Peterson, who is the question for?
Any one of them.
Mr. Chair, my name is John Langstein. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Health Protection at the Minnesota Department of Health. The intent with the bill is to address concerns that have been raised in over the bill that was passed off the floor of the House and the Senate last year that dealt with the long-term storage and use of specimens for purposes of the program's operation as well as any other research.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to get at the issue of the test results. You've talked a lot about the blood and that you're going to now, under this proposed bill, you're going to destroy all blood samples. In fact, my understanding is you've got well over 800,000 of them, that any of them that are greater than 25 months old will be destroyed about a year from now. But you then also have a lot of data in the form of test results. And I would like to know what the department's intent is with those.
Mr. McCann, I believe, you're the one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, yes, the intent of the Department of Health is to maintain the data, the numbers, the letters associated with test results in a secure, very private manner, as we have done since 1965, to the best of our ability, but these are with electronic records nowadays, because it allows us to have a program of excellence. It allows us to take a look at existing testing performance and better predict disease. These are rare disorders. We need large numbers to better predict disease.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, are those test results also part of the individual child's medical records, so at some point in the future an individual would need that information? Would they have access to it as a result of the private medical record between them and their doctor, irregardless of if the state had it or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, yes. As we report the newborn screening results to the birthing care providers, the hospitals, nurseries that are having these babies, it becomes an official part of the medical record. So those results are available through that avenue.
All right, and this new protocol requires a document to be offered to the parent prior to the screening that explains the parent's right, et cetera. Is this going to be like a official-looking brochure that it looks important, or is it going to be like a fluffy lemon-yellow brochure that looks like it belongs to a Similac company or this is an important issue, and all documents thus far that I've seen from the Department of Health to inform parents, quite frankly, would stack up real nice with a whole bunch of other advertising pieces that you get when you're in the hospital. And I'm just curious if you're going to redo your form so that it looks maybe a little more important.
Mr. McCann,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Holberg, this is the Representative Holberg's state of opinion historically as well, fluffy newborn screening piece. It's a 10-panel brochure that really highlights, I think, really nicely to parents in Minnesota what newborn screening is and how to assert and exercise their rights. We do intend, Representative Holberg and members of the committee, to enhance public health education when it comes to newborn screening. We've already taken steps. We've created the first of its kind, a communication education team. Nobody in the United States or the world has a small unit to actually help functionalize prenatal education, in the nursery education, as well as general education. We really hope to make this the best opt-out, best informed population ever.
And Mr. Chair, I still don't hear an answer to that question.
Madam, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the answer to your question is yes. We intend to replace that with a more official-looking form.
All right. I appreciate that information. And then, I guess at this point, I think other people have questions, and I'll hold mine.
Representative Champion.
One question. Consistent with trying to be assured that parents understand the information so that they can provide their consent, it's very clear that there's an emerging immigrant population here in the state of Minnesota, and what kind of mechanisms will you have in place in order to assure us as policyholders that individuals who speak English as a second language understand what's articulated in that, I think you said, 10-panel brochure in a way that they can clearly give their consent?
Mr. McCann?
Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent question. We do currently offer the newborn screening brochure in English as well as one specialized for the Amish culture. We do intend to enhance that in terms of addressing for the Hmong as well as Somali populations that have arose here in Minnesota, and also looking at other opportunities, other languages, and other types of tools to help inform them.
Representative Champion. Okay, any other discussion? Representative Holberg, are you back?
I think Representative Drazkowski had a question.
Okay, I wasn't sure if you were done, but Representative Drazkowski then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call vote on this bill if we could today. I would just ask either of the individuals from the Department of Health, and I try to learn more about this bill and this issue, but at the heart of it for me, it seems that there's a question about whose responsibility is it to care for the and look after the health of their child. Is it the parent's responsibility or is it the government's? It seems that that there's an assertion by the government that they have to be there, and if that the parent can't make that decision on their own, that's kind of, I guess, kind of troubling to me, but I'd be interested in your comments around that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Drazkowski, clearly parents have a responsibility for their children's health. Also, the benefits of newborn screening in addressing population health are clear. That's been documented repeatedly. So there is an important role of balancing and being reasonable, respecting parents' responsibility and rights for their families, as well as identifying conditions in newborns that could be highly impactful, leading to serious conditions that may develop or death. And families having that information is an important component of their ability to make responsible decisions for their children.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the example of the gal that testified earlier and talked about the value that she saw with her newborn infant and the newborn screening and how it helped her, is there any reason that people at that stage, as they're identifying problems with their children, can't take the blood at that point and conduct the screening? What type of disadvantage would there be to that approach?
Mr. Chair, if I could. This is just speaking from personal experience on this now. I mean, the fact is these are conditions, first of all, and I think some of the testifiers talked about this, the parents don't know they're carrying, so they don't, doesn't manifest themselves in the parents. The second thing is these are conditions that are often not something, because they're rare, providers often don't know what they are, and I think we had some testimony about that as well. So when the problem emerges, they can't put their finger on it right away. The third thing is these are conditions that actually have a fairly immediate impact, bad impact on kids, on the newborn, but that are very treatable if you catch them early enough. And so you probably could do the blood testing at the time that the condition would, for instance, in my son's case, with the condition that he had that was caught by the newborn screening test. when he started to get sick, you know, about 10 days after he was born, it would have taken quite a while to actually, because, you know, the symptoms could have been many, many things. It would have taken quite a while to actually identify what the condition was, and by that time, things could have gotten much more adverse. And so there actually is the advantage of taking the test, and I think everybody, even I think Ms. Braze and her testifier were acknowledging the fact that this screening program makes sense. And so kind of to that question, I think there is a real advantage of having it done immediately because you get the results back and can kind of make the right decisions early on.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions have to do with, maybe if you could just walk me through the way the law sets now and what you're proposing. When you go in to have a child, you have this baby, what is going to change on the forms that the parents sign from what the present law is?
Well, the way that and this language, again, was worked out last year, Representative Holberg was part of these discussions last year, about being much more specific and clear about exactly the type of information that has to be provided on the form. And you can see it. It's listed starting at the bottom of page, middle of page 2. I have a printout copy here. I'm sorry. Line 2.16 there about going down through 2.30 to the bottom, near the bottom of the page. That's the information that's provided in the form. And we also included language last year during the conference committee that we worked on to make sure it's not just that the form is provided, but that the parents actually have an opportunity to ask questions. And the provider has to sign off on both of those. It has to acknowledge that both of those things actually occurred. And then you can see what what objections can be made, et cetera.
Representative Scott.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask is we have friends who had a baby last year at Coon Rapids and at the Alliant Hospital there at Mercy. And they knew ahead of time to ask about, you know, maybe opting out of this whole thing. And everyone that they asked, it had to go close to, I don't know, almost to the hospital administrator before they found someone that could actually help them address this issue at all. So what kind of training is going on with the hospital personnel to better equip them to inform parents of what their rights are?
And Mr. Chair, one of the reasons we actually want to pass this law, which is an improvement on current law, is to make sure that that is what happened. And so it's clearly set forth in law what the requirements do. The law as it's written today, it's the crossed out part on page 2, isn't quite as clear as all that. So actually, one of the reasons we want to pass this law is to make sure that those conversations, that information is provided in a much clearer form than is, you know, in your Coon Rapids example. Had this law been in place when that happened, I would have hoped that, in fact, they would have gotten a much more clear direction.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stephen, maybe I missed something with when Ms. Grace was handed out this packet. Could you just clarify this issue, since I just don't understand it, about the what your response was to her about the use of the blood spots for research and private entities obtaining this information? That'd be helpful.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar. One of the things the bill is doing is now, under current law, you know, there's a dispute, obviously, about what's appropriate. But there is testing and research going on beyond just the newborn screening program. The way that this bill is defined, and I would direct your attention to Section 4 of the bill, which describes newborn screening operations. And that's what will be limited now under the law. And it's only for the 2 years, again, recall, instead of for in perpetuity. And then it's going to be actions, testing, and procedures related to the improvement, implementation, development of the screening program, such as testing the samples to make sure that, you know, we're getting the right results, and confirmatory testing, so, again, making sure we're getting the right results, quality control in the lab, calibration of equipment, and then improvement of newborn screening tests, and development of new newborn screening tests during that 2-year period. So that is what the bill would allow. But it wouldn't allow any research, which it actually is currently undergoing, as I understand it, outside of kind of the world of newborn screening.
Mr. Chair, I remember hearing this bill last year, I guess, when you introduced it, but I just wanted So that means a private entity then could request from the department specimens for testing.
Representative.
And that's current law, and that's still in your bill, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, I guess that is current law, and under the bill, some of the screening is done. The screening is actually not done by, or all of it, by the Department of Health. It's actually done by other entities who actually do the screening. And so that, so to get the screening done, these guys don't have the capability to do that.
Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar, regarding newborn screening, kind of losing my train of thought here. Just a minute. Repeat your question.
No, I just don't understand the process. Mr. Chair, I don't understand the process of how the private researchers or private entities are able to get access to the data, I guess, or the blood spots for doing research, and what kind of controls are placed upon them. That was the question I asked.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, the Mayo Clinic is a private entity. They are partners with us, and they do, as illustrated earlier and spoken earlier, have information to help us with newborn screening. Functionally, there are 10 tests performed in the state of Minnesota for all 54 diseases we currently screen for. 9 of them performed at the Minnesota Department of Health, 1 of them at the Mayo Clinic. Privacy protections are in place across the board. The types of studies, you can go to our website and learn about the types of public health studies we've been involved in, from quality assurance, quality control, new testing improvements, other types of public health studies, which are limited. These types of studies fall into two categories. One, that when there's any private health information associated with it, requires written informed consent. It's existing practice. There isn't actually acceptable by the Code of Federal Regulations, Chapter 46, to use a de-identified specimen, so one that doesn't have any private health information associated with it, to use that specimen as a de-identified study where there's no linkage there other than to a barcode. So it's blinded to the investigator.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of, I have one question and then one comment. So if this information is released, the name and the identity of the child is released, that's a crime, correct? Purposefully released.
To the public?
To the public, to anyone.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, if it were intentionally released by one of by the Mayo Clinic or by the department, that would be a violation of law.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney.
I remember one time about 3 or 4 years ago, we had the head of Mayo up here and had another data privacy kind of act, and I asked him the same question, what would you do if one of your employees released that information? He said to me, to our committee, when I think Representative Smith was the chair, that would be a crime. Mayo Clinic would step forward and help in any prosecution to the fullest extent. So I would expect them to still do that, or the Department of Health to still do that. But I'm looking at this state-by-state newborn blood and DNA retention policies, and many of you know I sit on the Bioscience Committee, and I'm looking at the states that have these long, indefinite newborn screening retention. They actually have some of the greatest medical facilities in those particular states. So basically what this bill is doing is shutting down research on newborn diseases. That's too bad.
Representative Pearson.
Mr. Chair, that would be correct. But we have to preserve the screening program above all, and that's why I've come to this conclusion.
And we're going to have to start wrapping this up.
I'm wrapped up.
Because we've got 12 more bills tonight, and we're not going to stay till 3 in the morning. Representative Scott, do you have a fairly quick question, hopefully?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This goes back to my line of questioning about, the parents being notified. Is there somewhere in this bill that I'm missing that there's actually an informed consent?
Mr. Chair, no, it's an opt-out, and by design, because that's how the program can work effectively.
Why wouldn't it be what the...
Research is, any research beyond the 2 years is an informed consent. And it's because of the way that the difference between opt-in and opt-out that you lose a lot of people in the process. but we are giving, as you can see from the bill, extensive information, and the communication between the provider and the parents are required under this bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just in application, how this works, when you look at page 2, lines 30 and 31, you're going to tell them where the forms are available. So are you saying the forms will not be available at the hospital for the parents to assert their rights?
Mr. McCann?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the forms should be available, and we're working with the Minnesota Hospital Association exclusively to help aid and assist better-informed parents.
Okay. And if I might, Representative Mahoney, you talked about the DNA and not having the name. Some people believe that DNA is more individually identifiable than fingerprints and don't really care about the name being there or not. But what would you say to somebody who said, okay, under this new program, you're going to destroy the blood, but because you're keeping the test results indefinitely and the nature of DNA, depending on what you keep, if you keep a full spectrum or whatever, that you don't need the blood anymore, number one. And number two, is it your intent to use the test results for research purposes without permission, given that you're going to keep them indefinitely?
Mr. Leichner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, no.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to what parts of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, to your last question, which is, will we conduct research without informed consent of the parents? The answer to that is no.
Mr. Chair, on the test results that you keep indefinitely.
Mr. Lichtenstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, as I understand your question, will we conduct research around what public health concerns may exist related to the results and information? We will conduct program operations to improve the quality of our tests or to examine the potential for new newborn screening tests. We will not conduct research that is outside the scope of newborn screening operations.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, on the issue of DNA, what do you say to the person who says, it doesn't matter that you've destroyed the blood spots. Once you run a full-spectrum DNA type of test, you have all the information that was contained in the blood to begin with, and you don't need the blood anymore because you've run this extensive DNA test, and you have everything you'd ever need absent the blood.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, a current practice and even future practice, we look at very specific mutation characterization to better predict disease. There's simple alphabetical characters, and there's billions of them. We're not doing full genomic sequencing on these things. They're very point specific to better predict disease.
And if I might, what in your bill would prohibit you from doing that full spectrum in the future?
Mr. McCann.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, nothing in the bill would prevent that from occurring.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
But, Mr. McCann,
it's incredibly cost prohibitive to do such a thing. It generates incredible amount of information, and at this, even this next 10, 20 years, I cannot see predictively any public health population-based screening program going down a path such as that. I can't see that happening.
And Mr. Chair, we also have the procedure that identifies the test, the conditions that we're going to do the testing on, that has to go through a process to get there. And the testing that they do is, you know, the 65, and we have a protocol in place. They can expand that, but we would be able to watch that expansion. So the tests are aimed. I mean, there's a process in place to address that question, I think.
Right, and Mr. Chair, I understand that, and the people that make that decision are basically true believers of the test, the screening board. There's been very, in my opinion, very little attention to privacy issues. When I look at this document, the number of parents who are refusing newborn genetic testing in 03,
2002 and now in 2008 up to 89. That concerns me. From my perspective, that's a reflection of a lack of trust to the Department of Health and what they're doing with this information. And I think we are putting kids at risk as a result of this. And so, I mean, I'm really hopeful that the Department of Health really gets on this full informed opt-out program and gets real with the administrative law judge rulings, and it only does what they're allowed to do. I would like to see something in the bill that limits the ability of the amount of information, because when this thing started in 65 with PKU tests, nobody envisioned that 40 years later we'd be sitting in where we are with this particular process. And the legislature gave the Department of Health very broad latitude to expand this program and the amount of testing relative to it a number of years ago in exchange for some pretty vigorous rights of parents that we are now 4 or 5 years later still trying to get a protocol in place that the parents have a meaningful opportunity to assert their rights. And so it's very frustrating, and for you to say we would never do that, we don't have the money to do that, there's nothing in the bill that would prohibit you from doing that, and who knows where we're going to be 10 years from now. It may not be cost prohibitive 10 years from now, and somebody may think it's a really good idea to do that on the committee. And I mean, I'm just concerned that you know, we've given you a lot of latitude, and I think that was a mistake. And I'm not real inclined to give you a whole bunch of latitude moving forward.
Okay. Members, we're at just short of 50 minutes by 2 minutes. So we're going to have to vote on this. We've just got to go on because there's 12 other bills, and we can't stay all night. I think Representative Holberg has made some strong points to you to consider. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Mullery.
Aye.
Representative Champion.
Aye.
Representative Duskowski.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Hortman.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Kelly.
No.
Representative Kulik-Jackson. Representative Mahoney.
Aye.
Representative Olin.
Aye.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Westrum.
No.
Passed is 8-5. Thank you, members.
It's very nice to have a committee. They actually leave in your committee rather quietly. It's delightful. Representative Mullery, would you like to move your bill and proceed with your testimony? We'll give the bill about 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So
I move House File 1448 and then so it's to the General Register. No, it doesn't.
Okay. No, it goes to Healthcare and Human Services Policy and Oversight.
Okay.
All right.
I move it to there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, when we did the healthcare directives and agents, healthcare agents, we didn't cover a lot of places in the law that were appropriate. And for instance, if I'm the healthcare agent for a close friend of mine or even a non-relative, then I don't have access to a lot of information, even though that person chose me to be the one that has all of the say as far as healthcare and things like that. And so basically that's what this bill does, is cleans up a lot of small sections where that's appropriate. And we have two witnesses here for that.
Well, before we go to the witnesses, is Representative Molly, do you know of anyone in opposition to your bill?
I have not heard from anybody.
All right. To the witnesses, very briefly. It's a great bill. We want to vote on it.
Thank you. My name is Amy Johnson. I'm the executive director of Outfront Minnesota. Before that, I was an attorney for 20 years in private practice. And I guess I will just add...
A great bill, you want to vote on it?
It's a great bill, and you need to vote on it.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, if I might, just can you tell me how you become a healthcare agent? Is this with an individual? I mean, are we giving somebody more authority than a family member, or...
Mr. Chair and representatives, only an individual can name their own healthcare agent, and it's done in a healthcare directive.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Kowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Holberg's question and response, so what does a healthcare agent do?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, a healthcare agent, first of all, there's a lot of opt-ins and opt-out in the actual healthcare directive. So I can say I want my healthcare agent to make, let's say, intrusive mental health decisions. I want my healthcare agent to make decisions about cremation versus burial or about organ donation. But this bill is not going to the scope of the power of the healthcare agent, but the access to information about the principal so that they can have the information in order to make those decisions. And what gums it up a little or adds some confusion is that HIPAA, the Federal Privacy Act, came after the legislature passed the directive. So there's some confusion. There could be, a gatekeeper could be confused legitimately about whether they can give that information. This is just a simple fix to make sure that the healthcare agent can get the information that's required.
And I'm sorry, just real quick, and for clarifying purposes, the healthcare agent, the scope of the information that they are allowed to obtain is only related to the rights that they've been given as a healthcare agent. In other words, if you haven't been given any right to make a decision about donor, then you don't get any information about donor stuff. That's correct?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that is true.
Seeing no further questions. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
On your way.
We can get out of here quickly if Representative Mahoney does the rest of the night. Representative Knuth, I guess, has to leave. Is she here? Oh, right in front. Representative Knuth, does somebody want to move the bill? Representative Fortman moves House File 362 to the General Register. Representative Knuth, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 362 makes a change in the notice a vendee has to give in order to be able to have its claim filed under or eligible under a warranty from written to written or actual notice. I have a testifier with me who can talk about this, but there are cases in which the homeowner has called up the builder and said, I found a problem, I found a leak, and they've gone back and forth, and within the 6 months of time, they've attempted to fix it, but there hasn't been a fix, and they can get caught if there's no written documentation that this has been going on, even if all parties were to agree and that there had been some actual notice. So this just kind of levels the playing field, and when we're not always writing letters back and forth, I think being able to, if there's clearly been notice given, whether it's written or actual, that's something I think we need to have happen for homeowners. Just to be open about what's going on with the bill under exclusions, line 2.11 to 2.13, I've been in conversation with the Builders Association at length for several days, maybe a week, and they have some concerns about a builder's being caught in terms of the actual notice, and they're not against actual notice completely, but they want to make sure there's some protection in there. We haven't come to an agreement on that language, and I'm still wrapping my head around why it's totally necessary, but I want to make sure people are aware of that. And with that, I'll leave it open to questions, and I have a testifier here if you want him to speak, or we could just take questions.
No.
No.
Okay. Ms. Burnett, did you want to...
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Burnett. I'm with the Builders Association, Minnesota. I'd like to just thank Representative Knuth for thinking about working with us on this bill. We understand that she hasn't totally gotten there, but we're hoping at some point we'll be able to come to a conclusion. As she said, we agree with actual notice. If a builder goes out and looks at an alleged damage and then breaches the warranty, that ought to be some sort of notice. However, we do have builders that do routine maintenance checks, and we'd like to make sure that they don't get caught in a gotcha situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Is there anyone else testifying on this? Okay, any discussion? Okay, Representative Hortman renews her motion to pass House File 362 to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed no?
No.
Carries. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Knuth.
You, Mr. Chair,
Representative Winston is one of these. Oh, okay. Hmm? I thought you were going to do all the ones. Oh, okay. Representative Winkler, I guess you're up. We were going to do all the warranties at once, but I guess you have a slightly different from a home warranty. Representative Winkler, does somebody want to move his bill? Representative Hortman, professional mover. Representative Hortman moves House File 1554 to the General Register. Is that correct?
No, Mr. Chair, I believe it needs to go to public safety.
Needs to go to public safety? Okay. Representative Hortman moves 1554 to go to public safety. Thank you, Representative Wickard. Go ahead. And
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I'm tired after a long day. When asked if I want a bill to go to the General Register, I was very foolish enough to tell you that it didn't. I'm trying not to make that mistake again. Mr. Chair, members, this is a bill to essentially modernize and clean up some of the... I shouldn't say modernize, because this is actually a fairly recent set of statutes, but to, I guess, bring up to the state of the art the mass dispensing and quarantine laws that we have for which would essentially amount to very serious public health emergencies. Mr. Chair, I'm sure you were here when these provisions were put into law to begin with, but essentially what we're dealing with is a situation where we've got a major public health problem, an emergency, and we're trying to find ways of getting vaccines and other kinds of drugs to people in a way that is not so much cost effective but possible because of what we're learning about emergency preparedness issues with regard to public health. The whole field of emergency preparedness has changed a great deal since 2001. And in fact, a level 3 public health emergency is something that the state is working very hard to try to get prepared for, and is one of the areas that maybe we're not, we haven't moved as quickly in that area as in some others. So this bill, I think, helps keep us moving along, and I'll have the Department of Health, Agen Reitheiser, go through some of the specifics, but essentially this keeps us moving towards the path of having a state that's ready to deal with this kind of emergency.
Could you state your name again?
My name is A.G. Lighthizer. I'm Director of Emergency Preparedness for the Minnesota Department of Health.
Spell your name.
A.G.I.E. Last name is L.E.I.T.H.E.I.S.E.R. Lighthizer.
L.E.I.T.H.E.I.S.E.I.?
S.E.R.
Oh, S.E.I.
My father would
say Lighthizer. Ms. Lighthizer, go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The first two sections of the bill are to remove the sunset that was attached to the ability for peace officers to assist in enforcing isolation and quarantine orders. And in Section 2, there's some additional change to make the language around how the peace officer enforces the court order or the commissioner's directive the same. So the language is the same for both kinds of enforcement. There's also a provision around the court process, including that the Supreme Court shall develop procedures to authorize and allow for medical experts and language interpreters. After the commissioner does a directive for isolation or quarantine order, the court must act in 36 hours. So it moves along very quickly. We want to make sure that those any barriers that might be in place are addressed. There's also some language to clarify the intent around payment for the appeal. The current language gives the choice as to whether to pay the court order to the individual, and we are changing the language so that the person, if ordered by the court, would pay the cost of the appeal. There's also language to clarify that the indigency standard is not applied at the original time of the order, so that, again, the person has access to a lawyer as soon as possible. The rest of the bill addresses emergency medication distribution. There's a variety of methods here. One is allowing businesses and churches and other groups to rapidly dispense medications to their members or their staff or their hotel guests. There's also a way of distributing medications to the head of the household so that we can get a lot of medications to people quickly if we need to. And then third is work that we've been doing with the United States Postal Service around distributing medications door-to-door under a special federal Food and Drug Administration authority. Part of that is about liability protection for the businesses or the churches who may be distributing medications, and clarity around the provisions and how that would work, and that they would still have the ability to seek reimbursement from the federal government. The next part is around volunteers, and we've added a couple of changes that the commissioner can request volunteers for assistance to the state. And the last part is around some clarification and harmonizing of the pharmacy law to make sure that the language around prescriptions and management of drugs is the same in the pharmacy language as it is in the other parts of the mass dispensing. And Mr. Chair, I would stand for questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, this was very controversial when it was put into law, and that's why there was sunsets on all these provisions. And reading through this brings back the whole process, and Representative Paymar is over there smiling because this was, I think, around bird flu time or something else, and there was a lot of discomfort on behalf of the legislature and granting these broad powers to basically control people's freedom, if you will. In order for any of these provisions to go into effect, does the governor have to order a state of emergency first?
Ms. Lighthizer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg. The isolation and quarantine provisions are not tied to a declaration of an emergency. The record of a person with a contagious disease might happen very quickly, and action would need to be taken quickly, so that it's not tied to a declaration of an emergency. The Emergency Management Act under Chapter 12 is when resources of local units of government are overwhelmed, such as is happening in the flooded areas now. It's not, and this may not meet that standard.
Mr. Chair, you're changing standards for the appeal process. And so tell me in practice how this is going to work if we have a major event in a low-income area of our state and the powers to be determine a certain behavior or treatment is necessary for a portion of the population that really doesn't have the resources to mount an appeal. What happens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I think that we're not really changing, the standard doesn't change. What the bill basically does is move the analysis of indigency to a later time to find out whether or not the person should have to pay for their own lawyer on appeal or not, so that you don't have to sit and do an analysis of somebody's income before you assign them a lawyer to challenge the quarantine if that's what they choose to do. So basically everybody would be entitled to a court-appointed lawyer right away, and subsequently you would work out whether or not some portion of that should be paid or not. And it's just for the appeal portion that the person would have to pay for it. So in a low-income area, it would have no effect whatsoever, except that they wouldn't have to go through the step on the front end of approving that they can't afford an attorney.
All right.
Representative Tamar?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg sort of got to my question, because I can't remember now why we had a sunset on the Section 1 on the police powers. Can you refresh my memory of why we put that in there?
Ms. Lisa, officer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tamar, the original full bill had a sunset date of 04, and then it was continued to 05. At that time, the language around enforcement was added, and because that was new language, a sunset was put on it, so it would be brought back to the legislature to look at one more time. The rest of the language was not given a sunset. The other piece that was added in 05 is around emergency vaccine administration and authorizing the commissioner to ask additional people to help. That was added in 05 and was given a sunset date of 09 as well.
Yeah, but the purpose for the sunset, was it the assumption that the legislature was going to analyze these broad powers in more detail when we weren't in the midst of, I wouldn't say we're hysteria at the time, but I think we were feeling this sense that we were unprepared, and you're right, Representative Holberg, it was a very controversial bill. Mm-hmm. But was that the assumption, was that we were going to reanalyze the kinds of powers that we're giving to the state, which are quite broad here?
Ms. Lighthizer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'll speak to my observations of legislative intent as opposed to trying to interpret legislative intent, if that's all right. It was very controversial, and I know that we went to many committees and had a lot of review and input and a lot of changes that occurred over the time, both in 2002 and in 2004 and 2005. At that time, in 2005, the sunset was requested to be removed. The sections that were added, though, the discussion and the compromise was, let's put the sunset on, let's bring it back and have more review to make sure that's indeed what we wanted to say. So that was my observation of the intent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Hortman renews her motion. Representative Champion?
Unfortunately, I wasn't here last session, but I have a couple questions. Now, it's my understanding of some of the research that I've done that under the state's distribution plan, here's my question, will the proposed plan allow inner city communities to be reached as quickly as suburban homes?
Mr. Chair and Representative, one of the provisions in here for mass dispensing that we're working on is with the U.S. Postal Service to deliver medications door to door. And that is most effective in a densely populated part of the community, so that we can, within 8 hours or a basic shift of a postal worker, distribute medications to about 1.5 million households in the Twin Cities metro area. Mass dispensing clinics will take a longer period of time because people need to come to the clinics to get the medications.
Representative Champion?
So is it fair to say that this private distribution system would create inequities in terms of rural and underserved communities, and how are we going to address that access issue, even though I heard that you said that you're working with the United States Postal Service?
Ms. Lifeiser.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's our intent that that actually the reverse might happen. It will be more difficult to get medications into areas that are more sparsely populated. And we're working with all of the metro counties and actually throughout the state of how do you do that, and we're trying various methods. The plans in the metro area are to get medications to everyone in the metro area within 48 hours of the decision to do so.
Now, it's my understanding of the legislation that in the event that your plan is not executed or does not yield the impact that you're looking for, that if a person was acting under this plan, or POD, I think is what is abbreviated, that there would be no liability that would flow to that particular person or organization or anyone. Is that true?
Ms. Lifeis.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the provision that's being proposed is that if a business or a church or a community organization chooses to work with their local health department and develop a plan, that they would not be held liable for their activities of distributing the medications. There's language in page 7, lines 12, and then 7, lines 21, that they would continue to have access to all the other benefits and the opportunity to receive compensation from the federal government if there was a problem or something that was verified.
And so, just for clarity, so if a death occurs as a result of this plan and not necessarily, the design of the plan and how it was implemented, then a person would not have a remedy available outside of a federal remedy, especially when we think in terms of the immunity question?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion, I guess I would also refer you to page 7, lines 19 and 20, where it says it does not apply in cases of malfeasance or willful or wanton actions. So it actually, what it basically does is take away the negligence standard from an action. And so, again, if you're in the high-risk situation of having to distribute these kinds of medications in a public health emergency, and you are a business or that wants to step up and be the point of distribution to do that, I think that it's a fair trade-off that you say that simple negligence can't get you sued, but as long as you're following the plan. Now, again, there is a federal remedy available, not a lawsuit, but there's actually a federal compensation system to deal with this particular kind of situation as well.
Okay. And I must admit that I'm not as well versed as some of the others that have, you know, seen this legislation before. But is it fair to say that when we think in terms of a person or an individual's negligence would be offset by the fact that they implemented the plan as designed by someone? And who would be the person designing the plan, and would you be able to, as a person who experienced a loss, be able to challenge the individual or the organization that created the plan as a design defect, and therefore would, you know, should be able to yield a remedy?
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Champion. Now, it does say that if the plan has to be approved by the Commissioner of Health and the local public health or the tribal health authority. And I guess your question is if they made some policy or error in their plan that led to a injury of some type, whether those entities could be sued in court, I guess, for negligence or other kind of direction. I think you probably know the limitations on liability that the state has in situations like this. And it's one of the reasons, for example, for the 35W compensation fund last year, because the state stacked the deck, essentially, against those plaintiffs. There are, however, certain damages up to $1 million for a single occurrence or $400,000 for an individual that could be found in that case. And so there would be some compensation if the state were had failed to do it correctly.
Okay,
Chair, if I might, I know you're trying, but, you know, these are important bills. I'm just going to make a comment, and then the bill officer can take it for what it's worth. Okay. But looking at the language on page 5, where we're now saying if you're not indigent, you must pay for the appeal, I mean, I don't think that given a broad Big Brother powers of this legislation and this process, I really don't think that financial considerations should be forced upon people of whether or not they want to appeal to have their, whether or not they're quarantined or whatever. So, and I don't know that you're looking for a revenue note for this to raise money. I can't imagine that changing that from a May to a month is going to get you much money. I would really hope that you could go back to the May standard and allow the court to determine whether or not somebody has to pay up.
Representative Winkler, very quickly.
Mr. Chair, just to Representative Holberg, what it says actually now is that if there is a motion made by the Commissioner of Health or the Public Health Board and the court orders it, then the person must pay. The language before actually didn't really make sense. It said that if there is a court order, then the person may pay. So it was like giving the individual discretion on whether or not they wanted to follow a court order. So the may to must doesn't change the need for the court order before they would be required to pay, just as if they have to follow the court order if there is one.
Okay. Representative Portman renews her motion to pass House File 1554 and go to public safety policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
All carries. Thank you, Representative Winkler.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, are we going to recess at this point at 6 o'clock or no?
We're going to do one quick fill and then we're going to recess.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, dinner.
Okay, the next that we have for consideration is House File 1237.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, and Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hilsum is moving that bill. What's the particular, what do you move, what's the motion? General Register?
I'm thinking, where would it go next? Public Safety?
Public Safety, maybe.
Oh, really? Public Safety? All right. Public safety
is where we go.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Eakin, to your bill.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a DNR technical bill, and the only provision that would be dealt with in this committee really would pertain to Section 12. And this language establishes a formal appeal process for dog and deer civil penalties, which means if there's dogs that chase large game animals, kills or pursues big game animals, right now there is a civil penalty for that, but there's no appeals process for when a civil penalty is implemented. And this would provide an appeal process through the Office of Administrative Hearings in the same way that there's other appeals for other penalties such as trespassing, OHD, an invasive species civil citation. So it's very similar. It's done in the same way. It's just if there was a civil penalty that was passed earlier that was standalone and there was no appeals process put into place. So that's what that deals with. And I have with me today Commander Jim Conrad from the DNR to answer any questions that members may have as well.
Okay. Questions, members? Okay.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes.
There's a question about where this bill has been and where it needs to go.
We do need some clarification.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Hill. We've already heard this bill, so we don't need it in public safety. Well, then.
So we can move this on to the general register.
That would be correct. And is that your motion, Representative?
That would be my motion, Madam Chair, to send it to the General Register.
All right. Any questions, members? All right. Would you like to renew that motion, Representative Hilstrom?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would renew the motion that House File 1237 be recommended to pass and be re-received and sent to the General Register.
All right. Any questions? Any further discussion? Anybody else wish to testify in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, with no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion passes. Okay, members, before we recess, please put everything back in your folders.
I don't want
to. Madam Chair.
All right. We will recess and reconvene at 6:30 in room 300 North. Representative Johnson.
Is there any chance we could hear Representative Scalzi's bill before recess?
I'm going to look through.
Need for finance.
What's that, Representative Holder?
I think transportation policy is supposed to start at 6:15 in this room.
Oh, all right. We'll have to recess.
All right.
Members of the committee. This bill, House File 330, is related to homeowner warranties with new construction. We've had a hearing in Labor and Consumer Protection, and we've had a hearing in the Commerce Committee. We had the same two hearings last year, but we had a problem in the Senate, so it never advanced. But this bill is a simple bill that changes two words from 6 months to 1 year. And to explain that is a homeowner would. This is from the time a homeowner notices a possible defect in their new home, construction defect. So they may notice, for instance, a little spot of condensation at one point of the year. And in the Minnesota freeze and thaw in the rainy season like we're having now, you might think that condensation is not something that's important, but it might take 6 months, 9 months in Minnesota's changing of seasons. Where it might be, all of a sudden you notice it again, you're outside of your six-month window for the time that you should notice and contact your builder. And in other states, this may not make a difference, but in Minnesota, I think it's kind of critical. And, of course, we would like to have our homeowners notify their builder as soon as they possibly can, but this just gives them a little extra time window. And I have with me here Fred Jacoberger, who is an attorney who has worked in these cases before, if anyone has any questions regarding this bill.
Mr. Jacoberger, I think we're going to see a lot of you today, apparently. okay, do you have any, you're just for questions, right? Okay, is there any opposition? Fernette, were you going to appear on this, or no? Okay. Yes, you do. Does anybody have any questions on the committee? Okay, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 330 and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Next bill is also Representative Scalzi is going to present House File 420.
Yes, and I'm a co-author on this bill, and Representative Wayne is on the Mexican Riviera for the wedding of her daughter. So I would gladly present the bill for
Representative Scalzi. We have to have Representative Mahoney is going to move it, I believe.
I move this bill.
And it goes to the General Register also. Representative Scalzi, go ahead and House File 420.
Yes, and this bill, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This bill has also made it to the Labor and Consumer Protection Committee and the Commerce Committee, and it would change the existing statutory, which states complied residential construction warranties, and it would change that to require them to be an express warranty to be presented in writing to the homeowner.
Mr. Jacob, are you just there for questions? Okay. Ms. Burnett, no? You are. Okay.
Chair members of the committee, I'm Lisa Burnett. I'm with the Builders Association in Minnesota. And the Builders Association supports making sure that all homeowners get a copy of the warranty statutes. As a matter of fact, most of our builders already make sure in their contracts that homeowners do get a copy of the warranty statutes. Our problem is the word express, that's up in the title, and we're concerned that opens up the warranties even further, and we'd like to see that word removed.
Is there any discussion on the bill?
We did discuss this with Representative Lane before she left, and she mentioned that the word express means express to convey a message to the homeowner. So that's all that Representative Lane told me. Mr. Chair, members, in an express warranty, you have implied warranties, which is the warranty statute that we have right now, and an express warranty, it's similar to if you purchase a toaster, the company gives you a warranty as to what they will do if something goes wrong with the toaster. If you break the toaster, you don't get another toaster. If the toaster doesn't toast, then you get another toaster. In this case, the builders aren't allowed to build the express warranties the way they should be, which is how it's normally done with express warranties, and that's our concern.
House File 420. Register all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Next bill for consideration is House File 1529. It's Representative Laurie. Your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would move House File 1529. I'm register.
Representative Laurie, to you, Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very worried about this bill because I have the support of the NFIB. I'm going to destroy my reputation in my district. However, Madam Chair, remember, it is actually a good bill because this is a situation where sometimes our departments get a little out of line and take cases where law isn't always on their side. And there's no recompense to the party who is fighting against the agency or other state action. And so we need to allow that. And right now there's a cap on the per hour rate as an attorney's fees at $125 an hour. And in many areas of the state, that just isn't realistic. And we want people to be able to hire attorneys that can present their case very well. So we have here tonight Mr. Hickey from the IB, and that's right, no wonder I didn't remember Mr. Maternoski, or close to that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Federation of Independent Business, and Mr. Chairman, we have a new coalition tonight. But in all sincerity, I want to thank Representative Mallory for coming forward with this bill. I've worked on this legislation for years, and the last big rewrite of it in 2000 with former Senator Amber Young, and this is a very important bill for small business. phone that you may be familiar with, district is trying to hang on and mount a legal defense. It's very difficult. And so eliminating this cap, $125.
Okay, now everyone check theirs.
I'm on stun or vibrate, so eliminating this gap will be very helpful, and more market type rates you're familiar with, and it's going to be charged when they're warranted. And without any further ado, I just wanted to introduce Joe Matanowski, who's had some experiences under this loan.
Matanowski.
Chair, members of the committee, pleasure to appear before you tonight, and attorney in private practice at the Moss and Barnett Court. I serve the Attorney General's Office, Specialist in Attorney General. I've had some experience with cases under the law, and but the chair is right, this rate at 125 was set when the law was initially passed in 1986. I think at the time, according to the legislative history, it may have been set as kind of a rate dealing with the outstate and the in-state, but nowadays there are few lawyers that are working at a 125 per hour rate, and the reason for the bill is to allow people to bring these cases when they've been agreed. I do want to make a point, this is not a loser pays rule. In order for the state to pay attorney's fees to an agreed regulated party, the state has to be wrong on the facts and the law before and during trial and through trial. So it's a very high standard for a party to come forward. But in those cases where the state does go too far, we believe it's a good remedy to have out there. Also want to point out that the fees will be at prevailing market rates and will be reviewed by the judge who's hearing the case. And the judges are in the best position to decide and determine what an appropriate fee is. And I think that's a good check on that could occur, which will not. Since the law has been enacted in 1986, there are no statistics on how many cases have been actually won under this law. I would say it's under 100 statewide. So it's a rarely used law.
Thank you, Mr. Matanowski. Any questions? Discussion? Representative Bilkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know your name ends the same way mine does, but
speak the same way.
The part about the judge determining the fees, is that in the bill currently?
Yes. It would be determined by the court. It must be determined by the court.
Okay.
The court would be looking at the hours expended, the rate of different attorneys working on the file. This basically lifts the cap, so the language in subdivision fees would govern over the specific subject that are now to be stricken.
Is there anyone else here who wishes to testify in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, and if there's no more discussion, would you like to renew your motion, Representative Mallory? If Representative Mallory renews his motion, the House File 1529 for your first general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, saying nay.
Jackson will House File 569 and post to the register. Representative Stiller, go ahead and present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I can be very brief because I should only address the things that you would like to have addressed in your committee, that being the antitrust provisions in this bill. And I will briefly mention that antitrust portions are on page 3, section 3, 3.1, 3.2, 3.3, just for your reference. But the reason that even had to come in front of this committee at all was simply because of the antitrust division. And without state legislation, if it's after state legislation, participation in this program would entail an unacceptable risk to all of the paint producers and retail folks and all of the manufacturers involved in this. And the risk could be mitigated by legislation that bars application of federal antitrust law under the state action doctrine. Under that doctrine, the federal antitrust law does not apply to conduct undertaken pursuant to a clearly expressed and affirmatively articulated state policy that displays or limit competition, and number two, is actively supervised by the state. And this particular bill what they want to do with this bill is manufacturers need to start a paint stewardship organization to undertake this pilot project, which again is only a pilot project for the state of Minnesota, and check out the way we're going to go ahead, if indeed we will go ahead with assuming producer responsibility for paint, which will in the end result in a great savings to counties and cities and lowering of property taxes for disposal of paint. The manufacturers have been working on this for about 6 years. They have all gotten together, but they cannot move to the next step without the antitrust exemption from the state of Minnesota. So I'm trying very carefully to make sure that I don't talk too much about this bill, because I know that people are a little sick of hearing about paint. But I did come here to address the antitrust issues. So if there are any questions with regard to that, I would be happy to answer those questions at this time.
I reference the sailor. Also, there's on page 3, it's non-public data, so that's also.
I stand corrected, Chairman Mulray, yes.
Is there any opposing testimony? Okay, is there any discussion? Okay, then Representative Jackson. Oh, was there? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this bill going to go to another committee like any passes? This is kind of like an ask.
Representative Saylor.
Chair Mullery, thank you for the question. Representative Scott, no, actually, we had it determined by the tax chair and House fiscal analyst. This is not a tax issue, and they did not want to see it there. Actually, I have a letter that I passed out at other committees regarding that, and if you like, I can dig through here for it because I will find it. But it was already determined that they did not want to hear taxes because the money never goes to the state. Therefore, it is not a tax issue.
So Jackson renews her motion to pass House File 569 and send it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. That carries. Just a second. Okay, I guess Representative Tilbury. That's pretty anxious. Representative Tilbury, this is, well, it's seen a lot of committees, and but this is, there's only one section, I believe, that is here.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's section 6, right?
Yes, the civil enforcement representative.
I'll move it to the representative.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney holds House File 253, and it goes to ag policy, I believe. Is that correct? I don't believe you have any amendments.
Not at this point.
Okay.
We'll have some amendments for the next two.
Okay. Good luck. Members, this is, as I said, Section 6, the reason it's here, and therefore, Representative Tilbury, I think all of us know about the bill. Try to confine your testimony to Section
enforcement. Particular measures in there. Which that might be different is the subdivision number one, which is corrective orders or correction orders. That allows inspections take place. That doesn't do make a difference in what they're doing. Otherwise, it could be all your animals. And this gives a chance for breeders to be able to fix something that is even that see in this section. Go through each one if you'd like, or stand for questions.
You have a one. Let's see if people want to do that.
What purpose of all? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment for everybody's knowledge. I don't know if this committee has any reason to turn Representative Tilbury's bill down. I've indicated to him, and I'll indicate it again here, that he has to satisfy the Board of Animal Health before he'll figure out a way to get me to vote for an ag committee. But as far as the Public Safety Committee and this committee, I am voting with him. Now, whether I would in ag without some explanation is debatable.
I believe there's a couple of people that wanted to testify in opposition. Susan Black and Robinette Donahue. And try to find your testimony to Section 6 of the bill. Civil enforcement. I believe you testified, as I recall, in so.
Legislative Chair from Des Moines. To 1,642 members. That we have asked. This bill criminalizes seizure concerns.
Well, Ms. Black, we've had testimony in a lot of committees on various parts of this bill, and I know that it got out of hand, safety, and people didn't talk about public safety, saying that. So you do have to read. This is on the civil enforcement. We have certain areas of jurisdiction that don't have jurisdiction over over the ag parts of the bill.
Concern about Fourth or Fifth Amendment.
Is that under civil enforcement? Why don't you try to do it very quickly and we'll see.
That's happening here. So there isn't, the concern I have is someone. What we've seen around the country, seizure bonds that people have to have several thousand dollars to keep their dog before they get to a place of due process. The thing that I see in there, I wouldn't have a problem with Minnesota law or U.S. law, but it says from any other jurisdiction. Albuquerque, New Mexico, if you walk a dog on more than an 8-foot leash, there's a bill in Illinois right now that is. should not be placed on high. Can be invaluable, and
experience having multiple animals is a certain plus. Answer your question.
Ms. Hansen? Was it Hansen?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Elaine Hansen. I do own pets. I have never owned and do not ever expect to own the number of pets that would be regulated by this bill. So I'm not speaking as someone who simply wants to escape from the law. The particular concern that I want to address to the committee is, in fact, with the civil enforcement, and it's not the process, it's the how you get to having anything to enforce. I'm very deeply concerned that this bill is set up so that private special interest groups will have an incredible level of influence in a government regulatory function. And I'm not addressing whether I think the government ought to be regulating in this field at all. It's simply that the people who will be the inspectors will be hired with grant money given to the Board of Animal Health, with gift money to the board. The board will pass that to local jurisdictions where people will be either hired as inspectors or designated as inspectors who are already on their staff as animal control officers or humane agents. Those people will be trained in the board's inspection procedures. I've not heard anything to indicate that the board has or wants to develop anything like that. I'm quite willing to bet that the same special interest group that's going to put up those grants has got a training program right in their pocket as we sit here, and will trot it out with a qualified trainer. And all of these inspectors can be, they will not necessarily be, but the inspectors can also be investigators of animal cruelty violations on behalf of their local jurisdictions. They will be at arm's length control of the Board of Animal Health with respect to their inspection functions. The Board of Animal Health will have no control over their activities as humane investigators. And I'm not suggesting that humane investigators aren't good people. There are many that are. Some of them are my friends. However, by being able to wear both of those hats, by being funded by a special interest group rather than state money, it's simply a scheme that I don't think is appropriate. Minnesota is known for having model laws, clean laws, laws that can't easily be abused, and I don't think that this is one of them by any stretch of the imagination. Thank you.
Motion to pass House File 253 and send it to A policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Carries.
Fiscal.
For instance, the transfers were child support goes. to move House File 1771 and go to the General Register, and I believe the parent is someplace in the
Mr. Chair, there's an A9 amendment.
Representative Scott moves the 215 amendments. To get the shape the author wants, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Scott, go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Chair, this bill allows for the automatic administrative redirection of child support. Currently, unless an obligee voluntarily authorizes redirection of the child support due him or her to another person or entity that has physical custody of the child or children, the public authority has to initiate court action to obtain an order for redirection. The Minnesota Social Services Association, the Minnesota Family Support and Recovery Council, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and then I was just informed that AFSCME is also is in support of this bill, along with county attorneys, support adding a provision to Minnesota statute that would allow the public authority to administratively redirect child support to the person or entity having physical custody of the child or children without needing to first seek court approval for such a redirection. In cases where the child or children are placed with another person or entity either by a court order or with the permission of the custodial parent, the public authority is required to continue sending the child support payment on behalf of the child or children to the former custodial parent unless the former custodial parent voluntarily authorizes the payment to be directed elsewhere. The public authority then has to seek... The public authority then has to seek court approval for the redirection using sources and court times that are already limited. So the consequences of no change here to this policy would be public authorities must continue to seek redirection of child support via court approval, the court approval process, which drain already limited resources and court time. This change will bring a modest savings to the state in courts in terms of money, but will provide much-needed relief in terms of human resources. This bill adds a provision to Minnesota statute that would allow the public authority to administratively redirect child support to the person or entity having custodial care of a child or children, subject to custodial and non-custodial parents' rights to object and request a hearing. The process for objecting and holding hearings is outlined in the bill. In short, a written notice is sent to the custodial and non-custodial parents and to the person or persons who have current physical custody of the child. That there is a request to redirect child support. If any of the three entities object, they have 30 days to request a hearing. If the hearing is requested and is held, the proceedings remain as they are in current law. If no one contests the action by asking for a hearing, child support is redirected by authority, by the public authority. And just as an example of how this would play out, if a mother has physical and legal custody of two children and she needs to be admitted to alcohol rehabilitation, she then sends the children possibly to live with her parents who are receiving public assistance. And the child support is still being directed to the mother. Well, this situation would alert the public authorities to send a 30-day notice to all parties that it has been requested to redirect the child support to the children's grandparents so that the money follows the children. And this is a bill that streamlines the process of redirection of child support in particular situations. And I'd like to introduce Ramsey County Attorney Mark Pansoli, who will explain the bill or take any questions.
I don't think he's the Ramsey County Attorney. Susan Gardner may be surprised that.
Okay, well, that's okay. You got the county right. And you got the county. Thank you, Representative Mullen. I was just going to add that. Thank you. I like my job as an assistant county attorney, so I appreciate you clarifying that. I am Mark Monsol. I am an assistant Ramsey County attorney, heavy emphasis on the assistant Ramsey County attorney. I'm the Human Services Division Director, and one of my responsibilities is child support. I'm also the chair of Minnesota County Attorney's Association Child Support Committee and chair of the Minnesota Family Support and Recovery Council Legislative Committee. Representative Scott asked me to appear. I helped draft the language. She did just a wonderful job outlining it, so I will be available for questions. I did want to add that the state child support office also supports this and is available to testify. And the Minnesota Fathers and Family Network is also supporting this and is available to testify. We brought along Ryan Beeman, who's from Freeborn County. He's the director of Freeborn County Human Services. He'd like to say a few words. And then Barry Bloomgren, the Hennepin County child support director, is also here. But since Representative Scott outlining the bill so well, I'd let them testify and stop until there's questions.
Representative Scott, I think you, I don't know, I know Mr. Elwood, I'm not sure, but do you want to very quickly, Representative Scott, you've I think that the votes, and the longer you go, the maybe you Representative
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Scott. I'm so convincing about all the money this was going to take court that I don't get asked about a public safety money.
Oh, okay. Representative Baker. Okay, so that's fine. Mr. Elwood, could you be very short? I think. Don't lose your bill for her.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I want to thank you, Representative Scott. Congratulations on your first bill. I just want to say thank you to the author and Mark Hunsell for accommodating some of the concerns that we had in the amendment here regarding providing some additional options in case there's extenuating circumstances on the grounds for redirection and also for providing some additional notice. We, of course, support the getting the child support to the right person to make sure that the child is taken care of, which is the parent. So thanks for bringing it forward. Thank you for letting me testify.
Thank you, and Representative Scott, I think unless there's an incredibly burning desire to testify in here, you'll get it out of here if we go ahead. Is there any discussion on this? Okay. Representative Scott renews her motion to pass House File 1771 as amended and send it to the Finance Committee with a recommendation to go to Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Kalin, 1532. Somebody want to vote? Representative Johnson. Nobody. Kalin, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1532 is...
People, please be quiet. We're trying to conduct a committee hearing here. Go ahead, Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1532 is the Secretary of State's, one of the Secretary of State's business practices, two housekeeping bills for the year. Mr. Chair, it's nice to be back in your committee staff, so I thought I'd bring a little bit of chocolate to tell you how much I miss you. But in the interest of brevity, I'm going to actually pass it along to my test partner, Bert Lax, who works on business practice law for Secretary of State.
What was your name? I didn't catch your name.
Thank you, Mr. Members, my name is Bert Lack, and I'm the legal advisor to the Office of the Secretary of State. And as Representative Kalin mentioned, this is a one of our technical bills. That the generally speaking, these provisions are developed by our professional staff. They've been in the process of going through all of our processes because we're doing a big online filing project, which should be up in about a year, and virtually everything will be able to be filed online at that time. When you go through a process like that, you find all the little glitches, all the little unusual rules that are that make for a less streamlined process, which is good for the customers as well as good for the programmers to find that out. And there are really three major parts of this bill. Two of them are exactly that. We have in many of these sections, we're eliminating the requirement that you have to file a certificate from other states when you're not a Minnesota entity. that requirement. Frankly, the practitioners, nobody looks at the record here in Minnesota. They're all now, given the facility with which you can do this on through the internet, they go to the home state and check out what the real record is, the legal record in the home state. So these certificates are redundant, and frankly, it's money that people are paying to other states, not to Minnesota. The second item here, and I think you have a narrative bill summary followed by a section by section summary, is concessions changed in the 545.05, which is the Bogus Filing Expedited Review Act of 2005. Those are provisions where you have uniform commercial code liens filed without any legitimate financial transaction. You'll find those sections in these 27 to 35 of the bill. Another large number of sections of the bill are for name protection. This is something that happened in response to something that happened earlier this year, and so we worked with the Bar Association to craft a solution. What happened was every year there are entities that they're supposed to file their annual renewals every year, and the entities that don't file, sometimes you'll find there are, I'm sure you're familiar with cyber squatting. Well, they do the same thing with name squatting. They go, and as soon as the name becomes available through dissolution, they file for that name. So a week after we had that this year, I got a call from the attorneys who represent the folks at St. Olaf's College. Somebody in the northern suburbs had filed for six or seven or eight different big-time names, familiar names, including St. Olaf College, Augsburg College, iNation, Ecolab, a number of other similar larger institutions. We were able to deal with the problems that St. Olaf and Augsburg College had because there's a quirk in the nonprofit law that allows them to reinstate the club without their name having to be available. But this is obviously a problem, and it's a problem that the Bar Association identified, frankly, a year ago, and we weren't, at the time, we couldn't craft an efficient solution, but now we can. We're going to put a placeholder to hold the name once the company is dissolved for 12 months, because they discover this. Any going concern is going to discover this in the course of that 12 months. Generally speaking, if they don't discover it within that 12 months, it's because they really have gone dormant. So there's a large number of provisions in the bill that relate to that. We also have a provision in the bill that currently, if you bounce a check or otherwise your payment for the fee doesn't go through, right now the law says we have to take the document off the public record, and then when you make good, we have to put it back on. That actually deprives the public of information that they need. So we have an alternative proposal to provide that instead. We simply won't take any more filings from that particular submitter or on behalf of that entity until they make the payment good. And we are required under current law to pursue making the payment good. Another item is in the central notification system, which deals with farm products. If you have a lien as a farmer against your crop, when you go to the grain elevator, the grain elevator has to pay jointly, a joint check with you, the farmer, and the bank. What's happened is many times it's been found that there's a termination that gets filed when you pay off the loan. Termination has not been filed, so in fact the loan's been paid, but the joint check still has to be made out. I'll try not to make it too much longer for you all. We're going to online filings for CNS, so the background is the same, but we're going to provide that with online CNS filings, that the lender has to have time documents in their possession before they can make the online filing, because the farmers were concerned about these filings being made when in fact they might be no longer on the transaction. Mr. Chair, unless you have some other questions, maybe I'll stop there before I introduce anybody else to bring this up. I'm sorry.
President Holberg's away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I
would
like to thank you for your comments on this. I'm looking at the repealers, and you're repealing information that was classified as public. And I'm wondering if you're repealing this because you're changing the classification of the data itself, or if you are, in fact, putting it in a different section of law.
Right. Mr. Chairman and Representative Holberg, that'd be on line page 25.30, and that section, 308B.121, it's only being repealed because it's redundant. It classifies annual renewal register information as public, but it is public. There's no classification of any of our business data as private. So under Chapter 13, it's all public. So that language is simply redundant. So that's the only reason we're putting that in, is because we don't want the presence of that language to imply to anyone that any of the rest of the information would be private.
Tell you that the economy has been unraveling for the last number of months. Traditionally, our seniors have relied on a three-legged stool for their financial security after retirement. A pension. A pension, assuming that they have one, Social Security, and earnings off of whatever investments or savings they may have. Obviously, with the collapse of the stock market over the last number of months, that third leg of the stool, the investment earnings, has been getting shorter and shorter. The concern here is that as the economy worsens and some of the seniors, some of the sometimes most economically vulnerable among us, get further pressed, they're also being aggressively marketed reverse mortgages that may or may not be suitable for them, may or may not be a good idea, and may or may not have the appropriate protections available to them. House File 528, then, is an attempt to put into place proactive preventative measures, especially in the growing but unregulated at this time proprietary reverse mortgage market.
while currently up to 90% or more of the reverse mortgages sold in Minnesota are federally backed and thus have consumer protections on them. There is a small amount of proprietary mortgages that were growing before the credit crisis, and once this credit crisis is resolved, will begin to grow again. Now is a key time to put in these pro-consumer, proactive measures before we start to see the growth again. With me today, unless... Mr. Chair and members, the AO90226 amendment is another show of progress towards agreement, the different sides on this bill. Page 1, line 2 and 3 assures that the default provision is only for non-federally insured reverse mortgage, is only for non-federally insured reverse mortgages, and the remainder of the amendment lines 1.4 through 1.9 tighten up the 10-day rescission period. As introduced, the bill had a 30-day rescission period. We heard clearly from the industry that 30 days was too long, and we've brought it down to 10. This tightens it further and ties it into federal regulations. I'd ask for member support.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Representative Dabney has said, the purpose of this bill is to be proactive and preventive to prevent the predatory marketing. I think the three main provisions, or perhaps four, is making counseling similar to the federal counseling that, as Representative Dabney said, 90% of the reverse mortgages are federally insured. The purpose of this is to ensure that all reverse mortgages sold in Minnesota also have the counseling protections. One of the other major provisions as Representative Dabney, right, rescission, I can answer any questions on that. The stability provision, that even though we've added counseling, it's still responsible lending, so that the lender has to ask questions, ensure that it's suitable. As Representative Dabney said, reverse mortgages are good products for some seniors. However, they're not for all seniors. And that goes with the last provision also, with cross-selling, the prohibition of using proceeds from reverse mortgage to buy an annuity or long-term life insurance. And those protective measures, we hope to be preventive and get out in front of any predatory reverse mortgages in this. Counseling for all proprietary mortgages in Minnesota, not just the federally insured. And as it is, it's the buyer who has to pay for the counseling, but that's taken out of the proceeds of the reverse mortgage generally.
One way.
You know, Mr. Chair, as you know, I've been involved with the HECAP funding for foreclosure prevention and assistance. I have not been involved and am not aware of funding for reverse mortgages. That may simply be my lack of awareness.
The representative has probably match up with one of the
if it hasn't been, we probably will this year.
Yes. Okay, we have Matt. This is Matt Hewer.
Thank you.
teach reverse mortgages by that. I've been specializing in reverse mortgages for 10 years, and so I'm bringing my expertise to this bill and discussion. I've done hundreds of loans through the years, including the HECM, which are the home equity conversion mortgage insured by FHA, as well as the proprietary products when they were available. They have not been available for about a year now, and there's no talk at this point of bringing them back anytime soon, so we're just kind of, like I think Carla said, being proactive. So far, all of our, and I expect that to continue, all of the loans that we have done have been insured by HUD, and we have had no rescission. So we're very proud of that because we are very thorough. Additionally, I've written books to help the seniors understand reverse mortgages, and I, too, care very dearly about the seniors. I work with the senior advocacy groups as well as adult protection. And I agree in principle with the bill. However, I'm concerned about some of the restrictions that are in the bill will either send lenders away from the state so reverse mortgages won't be available, or at least limit the number of lenders that would be available. HUD and RESPA both have regulations in place, and when we did have the proprietary products, they were modeled after the HECM program with in regard to counseling as well as the application and closing documents were the same and with the same disclosures. Counseling is required by HUD and the borrower. There was the question about the counseling. Right now, HUD did run out of funding. Some of the counselors get some grants, but HUD does allow the counselors to charge the borrower up to $125 per counseling session. I'm suggesting, and I agree, that the proprietary products be required to go through the counseling. They did, but let's just put it in and make that firmer that it is law here. The section on lender default and forfeiture, I believe that has excluded the federally insured loans. If and when the proprietary products come back, that could be an issue where lenders would just not lend here and or require that 100% of the money be pulled out up front, and then that's when there's the risk of them investing in the annuities, which we are all saying that may not be the right thing. So I want that to be considered as looked at. The lender responsibility, the originators, employers should be responsible for the acts of the originator versus the lender that we sell our loans to, because they do have responsibility agreements. The right of the rescission I want to highlight the most. While we did get it down to a 30-day, from the 30 days down to 10, the 10-day is still going to be very, very difficult and risky for lenders, which could mean more cost to being passed on to the borrower. Generally, it takes 30 days from the time of the counseling or application to get through the counseling. I'm sorry, to get through the process. And then they do have the 3-day rescission, which they can cancel at any time during that up through the 3-day rescission, as well as they get to choose when the closing is scheduled. So they have a lot of control at that. The loan, I think we just covered, will not fund until after the rescission period is over. What's going to be impacted with anything longer than the 3-day rescission is the interest rates could be affected, which means less funds available to the borrower, and higher margins could be implied, which means longer or higher costs to the borrowers over the term of the loan. Right now, the HECM lock periods, I think, different than a forward, and on the reverses, it's actually going into effect just on April 1st. Until now, we have not had the lock like we have. And it's 10 to 30 days, depending on the lender and what their requirements are and when that would go into effect. And that's going to mean higher costs to the borrower because higher margins the longer the lock period is. Managing payoffs will be difficult with a 10-day rescission, foreclosure issues, especially now, paying property taxes timely. Another big risk is the judgments and liens that could be placed on the loans with a longer period of time during the rescission, which could impact the exposure of the title companies, which may mean that they're going to increase their title insurance, and that would be passed on to the borrowers. Or it could also mean limiting title companies that are willing to take that extra risk. Property insurance is an issue with that, of which lender is going to be bound. And then one of the other things is the investors who are purchasing the loans, which right now is Fannie Mae, and insuring HUD insuring the loans, the timing of that has just recently been tightened up, and that may mean it's a higher risk to the lenders, which means higher cost, because the lenders have a certain period of time to get the loan insured by HUD and then back to the investor. Otherwise, the lender has to buy that loan back. So I just have a lot of concerns about the 10-day. I would like to see some other things done where we can protect the seniors, give them time and to review the documents, but not limit and risk put risks to the borrowers and more cost to the borrower, and possibly limit lenders. And I'm just going to leave that and focus on that, because I think we're going to discuss some of the other issues. That's the biggest one I have right now.
Ms. Patterson, first, I assume the 3-day would apply, wouldn't it, if we didn't extend it to 10?
Yes.
We have the 3-day, and having represented the biggest title insurance company, I don't agree with Michigan 7-1 title insurance companies that are there after discussing a wealth law. But I think some of your other points may be.
Still an asset, and it's becoming, as
Chair, Representative Kelly. There are other representatives of the industry that I've spoken with that, as I understood the conversation, they are comfortable with the prohibition on cross-selling. And I think Ms. Patterson has shared her concerns about the inappropriateness of cross-selling. I'll obviously allow her to speak for herself. This is one of the areas that is of most concern because it's one of the areas advocates for the elderly have seen many of the abuses. And there, I think, lies the root of the prohibition on cross-selling. It's very difficult to enforce a more subjective rule on cross-selling than the clear, bright line that we're offering in this bill.
Thank you. Federal law actually, through HUD, did implement cross-selling, prohibiting cross-selling. The biggest issue is when the originator and the insurance agent is selling, and that's, I think, the biggest concern there, because what has happened is that the insurance agent is saying, oh, let's do a reverse mortgage so that you can pay for the insurance products, and then they're getting paid on both. So that is the biggest concern and why the cross-selling law did go into effect. So I think there's maybe some room for discussion on how this is worded, but I, you know, not prohibit it to be done, but that the same not selling it.
Mr. Chair. Anderson, I think having